Chapter 9, Twisting the Kaleidoscope. I can't remember exactly when I first read about the mysterious virus plaguing Wuhan. It had to have been in mid-January 2020, though. By the time China locked down Hubei province on January 22nd, I'd developed a healthy, or unhealthy, curiosity about what was happening. Why? I had decent excuses. I'd covered the drug industry for several years during the aughts as a reporter for the New York Times. Along the way, I'd learned a fair bit about medical research. I'd always been interested in epidemics and bioterrorism, too. My first novel, published in 2006, featured a detailed look at how terrorists might use a plague against the United States. But really, why did any of us get interested when the virus was so far away, the video so hard to trust? If we're being honest, it was for the same reason we read about the Black Death or watch movies about asteroids hitting the Earth. The prospect of mass sickness, societal collapse, and ultimately human extinction, no matter how far-fetched, concentrates the mind. End-of-days cults exist for a reason. It's so much more exciting to believe you'll see the apocalypse firsthand than to face the harsh reality that, in the words of Charles de Gaulle, the cemeteries are filled with indispensable people. Sooner or later, you, too, will be one of them. So I read everything I could, and I waited for the world to panic, and waited. Near the end of January, with the Chinese building field hospitals in Wuhan, I asked a retired hedge fund manager I knew why big investors didn't seem more concerned. He pointed out that the original SARS had petered out after generating frightening headlines. The 2000 swine flu had come and gone without a trace. Most people expected the same this time, he said. Panic rarely paid off. Fair enough. Still, I was concerned enough about the virus that I considered postponing that mid-February trip to New Zealand. I was in a hotel near the southern end of New Zealand's South Island, a long way from the rest of the world, when I heard that Italy had suddenly locked down towns near Milan. The news struck me as world-changing. Italy? Weren't we supposed to be worried about South Korea and Japan? We had obviously lost any chance to contain the virus within China. Like Neil Ferguson, I feared the worst. On February 22nd, I tweeted this warning. Coronavirus is coming. It's highly infectious. It doesn't have a cure or a vaccine. It badly sickens 1 in 5 people who get it. It kills, well, we don't know, maybe 1 in 50. And we can't contain it. It is going to roll around the globe in waves. 5 of the 7 sentences in this prediction would prove correct. But the 2 that were wrong, the 2 in the middle, mattered far more. Coronavirus didn't badly sicken 20% of the people who got it. It didn't kill 2%. On a worldwide basis, both estimates were off by a factor of almost 10. The difference between a pandemic that could rock the world and a very bad but manageable flu season. At the time, though, the numbers seemed to be in line with what the data from China showed. If anything, I thought I was being conservative. And even a 1% death rate would mean that more than 3 million Americans and 80 million people worldwide might die. When I got back from New Zealand, I loaded up on non-perishable food, basic first aid gear, and cleaning supplies for our family. In the back corner of a Walmart, I found a few precious N95 respirators and snapped them up. My wife Jackie, a psychiatrist, viewed my growing alarm with some amusement. Like all psychiatrists, Jackie's a fully trained medical doctor. She'd been born in Canada and lived there during the original SARS epidemic. She remembered how quickly SARS had vanished. She had also just started a tough new job running an inpatient ward at a big hospital. Taking care of real patients with real problems left her little time to indulge in COVID fantasies. After March 11th, though, neither of us could ignore the fact that COVID was about to upend our lives. School closures appeared imminent. Our nannies were about to quit, leaving me to watch over our infant and 2 school-age kids. I feel compelled to explain that 1 nanny worked 2 days a week and the other 3. We did not have 2 full-time nannies. I should have panicked that week as Europe shut down and the virus came to New York. Instead, as I watched the fear grow, I went the other way. Journalists fall into 2 categories. Inside reporters are good at getting powerful people to talk to them. Outside reporters prefer to dig up facts those people would rather not discuss at all. I had always been an outside reporter, naturally contrarian and cynical. I was comfortable poking through databases and papers and reaching my own conclusions. And I started to wonder, did shutting the economy really make sense? What would happen to people forced to stay in tiny apartments as the weather warmed up? everything I had read suggested that kids weren't at huge risk. So why were we in such a rush to close schools? My skepticism ramped up day by day. On March 16th, the Imperial College Report, Neil Ferguson's masterpiece, came out. I read it that night, reread it again. I kept coming back to the table on page 5, the one that had estimates of the infection fatality ratios by age. At the top of the table, age 0 to 9, 0.002%, 2 deaths in 100,000 infections. Age 10 to 19, 0.006%, 6 deaths in 100,000 infections. Both of those estimates were probably high. At the bottom, age 80 plus, 9.3%, 9,300 deaths in 100,000 infections. I had known the elderly were more vulnerable to COVID than the young. I hadn't had any idea how much more. This gold standard report said the oldest people were thousands of times as likely to die as the youngest. I could almost feel the scales dropping from my eyes. I'd had similar experiences as a reporter before. In 2004, investigating the stun guns called tasers for the Times, I discovered a document showing their manufacturer had researched the full effect of its electrical charges on only one pig and 5 dogs before decreeing the weapons non-lethal. What? You're telling police officers these can't kill people on the basis of experiments on 6 animals? In 2017, after Jackie repeatedly told me to read the scientific research about cannabis and mental illness, I finally did. I found that the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine had said in a 500-page report, cannabis use is likely to increase the risk of developing schizophrenia and other psychoses. The higher the use, the greater the risk. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine was chartered to offer the federal government advice on complex scientific questions. So as the United States moved to legalize cannabis, how come no one had even heard about this report, much less read it? Both times, those documents didn't mark the end of my research. They came closer to the beginning. But they twisted my internal kaleidoscope. They helped me see. So did the Imperial College report. As I read it, I wondered why the media wasn't explaining that SARS-CoV-2 was far riskier to older people than everyone else. Why we weren't focusing on protecting the old rather than locking down the young. And how a virus that posed at most a minor threat to anyone healthy under 50 could really be the worldwide menace we'd been told. I'd learned firsthand that the media couldn't be trusted to tell the truth if it was ideologically inconvenient. When Simon & Schuster published Tell Your Children, my book about the psychiatric health risks of cannabis in 2019, I expected the marijuana industry to pummel me. But I felt confident that major news outlets would give the book a fair hearing. After all, Tell Your Children drew on evidence from the world's most respected medical journals. And I thought the investigative work I had done at the Times would give me credibility. I was no right-wing apologist. I even acknowledged that one could understand the risks and still favor legalization. Further, just before the book appeared, Malcolm Gladwell drew on it at length in a New Yorker article about cannabis. He said that I had a reporter's tenacity, a novelist's imagination, and an outsider's knack for asking intemperate questions, and that my findings were disturbing, even though he didn't necessarily agree with them. That take struck me as fair. I assumed that other reporters would have a similar response. Instead, top media outlets, including The Times, either mocked or ignored Tell Your Children. NPR stations scheduled and then canceled interviews. They were unwilling even to discuss the potential dangers of cannabis. The response surprised and disappointed me. When I had worked at The Times, it had leaned left, but it had been committed to accuracy and truth-telling above all. Now it seemed to have abandoned any pretense of being nonpartisan. I could already see COVID coverage falling into the same trap. On March 25th, Neil Ferguson spoke to the British Parliament's Science and Technology Committee. Ferguson gave his testimony remotely. He was actually infected with the coronavirus at the time. He had contracted it a week before and was recovering. It was like a rather bad flu, he told the committee. For a couple of days, it was quite unpleasant, but I think I'm basically on the mend now. The world would subsequently learn just how on the mend he had been. But Ferguson's firsthand report on COVID was the least interesting part of his testimony. 9 days before, His Imperial College paper had warned that, without immediate action to shut society, the coronavirus would kill more than 500,000 Britons. Worse, even with school closings and social distancing, hospitals would be overwhelmed through at least mid-May. Mitigation measures would have to last at least 3 months, then cycle on and off. Still, 250,000 people were likely to die. Only suppression could keep deaths down. Only a vaccine could permanently solve the crisis. Ferguson's report had used clear, direct language. The interventions need to remain in place for as much of the epidemic period as possible. Given that mitigation is unlikely to be a viable option without overwhelming healthcare systems, suppression is likely necessary in countries able to implement the intensive controls required. But on March 25th, with the United Kingdom having entered lockdown only days before, Ferguson offered very different predictions. The British hospital system would not be overrun. The number of patients in intensive care would peak and begin to fall within 3 weeks, he said. Ferguson had changed his view on lockdowns, too. "We clearly cannot lock down the country for a year," he told the committee. In fact, in 3 or 4 weeks' time, he expected to replace the current regime of lockdown. But even without a prolonged quarantine, Ferguson now predicted that the number of people who would die from COVID in Britain would probably be unlikely to exceed about 20,000. Up to 2/3 of those people were so sick they might have died by the end of 2020 in any case, he said. Not 500,000, not 250,000, not 100,000. 20,000. Ferguson had just reduced his death estimates for the coronavirus, the same estimates that barely a week before had shocked the world into lockdowns, by more than 90%. The testimony generated a few articles in British newspapers. "UK has enough intensive care units for coronavirus," expert predicts, the New Scientist reported. 2/3 of coronavirus may have died this year anyway, government advisor says, the Telegraph explained. But no one in the United States seemed to notice or care about what Ferguson had said. Until the morning of March 26th, when I linked to the New Scientist article and tweeted, "This is a remarkable turn from Neil Ferguson." I'm not exaggerating when I say that tweet, actually a thread of 5 linked tweets, changed my life. Over the next day, it went viral. Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, retweeted it. So did Donald Trump Jr. More than 6 million people saw it. Suddenly, I was part of the political and scientific wars exploding over the coronavirus and lockdowns. What I found so strange about the response to my thread was that I wasn't saying anything Ferguson hadn't said himself. Ferguson had seen new evidence about the coronavirus, evidence that it was spreading faster than he'd previously believed. He'd said in his testimony that he believed the virus had an R of 3, meaning that each newly infected person went on to infect 3 other people. His previous estimates had been in the range of 2 to 2.5. What we have been seeing, though, in Europe is a rate of growth of the epidemic that was faster than we expected from early data in China, he told the committee. The difference may seem small, but even a small-seeming difference in the infection rate has large implications for a respiratory virus with a short infection cycle. Over a month, a single infection with an R of 2 can become 50 infections, but 500 for a virus with an R of 3. And paradoxically, from the point of view of dangerousness, a higher R may be good news. Why? To make the math simple, imagine that 10 people are hospitalized with COVID over a month. If only 50 people are infected that month, the coronavirus has put 1 in 5 of the people it infects in the hospital. But if 500 have been infected, the virus has only caused 1 in 50 to be hospitalized. More infections means the virus is less dangerous per infection. Thus, Ferguson had updated his prediction, as serious scientists should when they get new information. Of course, they also have a responsibility to colleagues and the public to be transparent about the changes they're making. His revised forecast was good news. When I retweeted it, I expected people would be pleased. I was wrong. The only happy people were either conservatives, such as Trump Jr., or coronavirus skeptics, such as Musk. In the next few days, journalists from the Financial Times and elsewhere defended Ferguson. They claimed, with his support, that he had not changed his prediction, that the new forecast was consistent with the original March 16th Imperial College report. This argument was nonsense. Again, the original report had said that even a short-term lockdown would not reduce British deaths below 250,000. I wish I didn't have to spend so much time on Neil Ferguson and his predictions. They may seem like inside baseball. They aren't, though. And not just because Ferguson's initial report was so crucial to lockdowns, both in Britain and worldwide. At the time, I didn't know much about Ferguson, including his long history of failed predictions. But I knew he was a crucial voice. The way reporters circled the wagons around him made it clear to me that in spite, or maybe because of COVID's importance, journalists would not be honest in reporting about it. Health authorities had gone all in on efforts to stoke coronavirus hysteria, as the March 22nd Sage paper would reveal when it was ultimately released. Reporters were working hand in glove with government agencies to stoke fear in people at low risk, no matter if they had to lie to do so. They would attack anyone who offered facts that didn't fit their preferred narrative. They would even rewrite history, history that was only 10 days old. I could tell you that I had to decide in March 2020 if I was ready to fight. I could tell you that I carefully weighed the cost of potentially angering Simon Schuster, my publisher at the time, and the personal hate I could already see I would face. But I didn't. In 2006, as a Times reporter, I was given access to files from Eli Lilly, a big drug company. They showed that Lilly's medicine Zyprexa caused terrible weight gain and even diabetes in many people who took it. Zyprexa was a drug given to the severely mentally ill, among the most vulnerable people around. I wasn't supposed to have those documents. They were sealed under federal court order. I didn't care. I had a story that people needed to hear, facts they weren't getting elsewhere, facts that could help patients and doctors make better choices. The Times didn't care either. Eli Lilly said to play down risk of top pill, read our front page headline on December 17, 2006. The federal judge who had sealed the documents later called me reprehensible for my role in breaking the seal. It may have been my proudest moment at the paper. March 2020 was no different. Reporting wasn't a choice. It was an instinct.